Welcome to Stargate SG Fun, a podcast where we discuss the original Stargate series and spend more time on the episodes that we like and think are important, but we try to cover them all at least to a little extent. I'm Trishy Mattson.
I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm David Schaub.
And today we are discussing Season 2, Episodes 17 or 18, Holiday, 18 or 17, Serpent's Song.
Oh, no.
Depending on who is counting. 19, One False Step, and 20, Show and Tell. Why don't we start off with an interesting episode, Serpent's Song, which is certainly very important to the arc of this series.
Okay. SG-1 gates to some received coordinates and finds a wounded Apophis looking for sanctuary. Holy buckets. Carter explains that Apophis has been fatally tortured. Apophis wants a new host. O'Neill wants him dead. Jackson wants info on Share. Carter wants to know how to defend against Sokra. Apophis' hosts wants to wake up from this nightmare. Nobody gets what they want. Actually, Teal'c gets to gloat. That's pretty great.
Yeah, that was fun.
The Tok'ra return to SGC without splattering onto the Iris, luckily. Sokar attacks the Iris with a particle beam, using it as a screen and a speaker, but he doesn't tell anyone anything they didn't already know. But the Iris is slowly getting burned through. The president signs with practicality and tells SGC to let Apophis die and give Sokra the body. Apophis dies, but the host lives long enough for Jackson to respect his culture's death practices. They send Apophis's body to Sokra, who seems to go away. Martouf tells everyone that they accomplished nothing, but at least the Tok'ra have a GDO now.
Yeah.
Just again, a common refrain here. Sokar?
Sokar.
Sokar, yeah.
I believe so.
Not, it sounded like you were saying Sokra? Maybe?
I may have. I did write Sokar in my notes.
So the episode title, Serpent's Song, I'm not quite sure what they meant by that. It might be referring to a prisoner singing, you know, telling stuff, which is what they are trying to get Apophis to do and what Apophis keeps promising they'll do, that he will do, telling the Earthlings how to protect themselves technologically against Sokar, if only they will give him a host. But they rightfully keep turning him down. So maybe that's what Serpent's Song was about, or maybe they just liked the alliteration.
Well, I was also thinking of Swan Song.
Ah, yeah, point.
You know, his last last moments, of course, not his last moments, but... And yeah, they really like using Serpent in the titles when it's a good arc story. And, you know, I'll give them that. That works.
I could have done with some singing, but it's okay.
Well, we get singing in one of the other episodes that we'll be covering today. Okay, so, yeah, I really enjoyed Teal'c getting the opportunity to gloat.
To gloat, yeah.
He certainly deserves it. You know, this is the god of his people that has ruled his people and lied to them and used them for thousands of years. And so, you know, I certainly think he has some justification for twisting the knife a little bit verbally as the dying Apophis suffers.
Well, and O'Neill is pretty smug as well.
He is. He really is.
At various points.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also kind of fun.
And Daniel even is quietly threatening. You know, he says, basically, if you don't tell me where Share is, I'll kill you right here. But then, of course, he doesn't follow through on his threat.
Yeah, he's pretty bad at it. Yeah.
I appreciated that Jackson entirely lied regarding trying to get into the interrogations. Like, give me a hand at this. I know all this stuff.
And
it's
like, yes.
No, you don't know anything about this. You just want to talk about Share. And it's like, okay, fine. He could have probably just said the truth.
Right. Unfortunately, this means that since he thought Apophis was going to die, he went ahead and told him, by the way, your son is alive and he isn't with Haroun.
Yeah.
And then we find out at the end of the episode that, no, Apophis is not going to die. So Carr will just pop him into a sarcophagus so he can revive him and torture him to death and revive him to torture him, you know, again and again and again, which really, really, really sucks for the host. Poor host.
I remember when I first watched this many years ago, that ending felt like a revelation, felt like something that was kind of a surprise, kind of a twist. And I think watching it now, there's at least two times in the episode where they mention, well, if we had a sarcophagus, we could save him or something like that. So it's not like they're keeping it secret. Up until that point, I think the idea was for me, that this long period of time they dealt with in this in the episode of showing him dying, showing this slow death and coming to terms with it and seeing the host finally, and just the fact that it just kind of gave it this whole process in the episode really made it feel like this was the real thing. This was actually going to be his death, even though story-wise, there's absolutely no reason why send him to somebody with a sarcophagus.
I don't think we had heard before that a sarcophagus can revive someone from actual death. Near death, plenty of times. I don't think we've had an actual dead person or snake being revived before now that we know of.
With Jackson in the movie, that seemed like he was really dead dead. He was shot, he was fell down, he was gone, and they brought him to the sarcophagus and they revived him. That's what I remember anyway, but maybe there are other interpretations.
We also hadn't seen it heal the Gould symbiote as much as just healing the host body, because it really is the Gould dying that was the real problem in this case.
Yeah, that's true.
And the Goulds died well before the human host did in this episode.
That's true.
Hours before.
Which was really amazing. That's also what gave so much weight to this, because we've often seen when watching the show how well the show creators, the directors, the writers, whatever, whoever's doing it, just the actors maybe, whenever they're told to basically go between being a Gould and the host, they do a pretty good job of it. And this was a great example of that, where that host comes through and it's like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
You don't even understand a word they're saying. And he does an amazing job with it.
Yeah, speaking ancient Egyptian, I mean, I'm sure it's not like really ancient Egyptian because nobody knows what that sounds like. But
right, we don't know what the pronunciations were at all.
But it was really, really convincing. It was really great. And that's Peter Williams, and I've mentioned the name before. I think he's great.
Mm-hmm.
I think they've gotten lucky in the show because there's been a number of those actors, the actor who plays Scarum.
Yes.
Even the actor who plays Sharang,
mm-hmm.
that they can switch back and forth. And even Carter. All of them can do that really well. And given what seems like the level of direction in a lot of these episodes, I don't think they're getting it because of masterful direction. I think they're just kind of got lucky that these actors are are willing to throw themselves into playing these two different characters. Yeah, and it's got to be a fun thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But man, I liked him. I've liked him in the past for all this stuff. And I think watching again, he's just, he has exactly the right tone for these characters. Like they weren't trying, when it's Apophis, it's generally kind of campy. But you know, this, they were kind of, it was still a little bit. He was still very flamboyant, but he was also, they took it seriously. They took his death seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And then the host, just great. I mean, it really came across as a completely different character. And I do think this show does take shortcuts in many ways. And one of the ways is often not really worrying too much about the host. Like SG-1 will kill Gould and just not worry too much about the fact that they're killing an innocent person with it.
Right.
But they did give themselves kind of, this episode really didn't do very much else except that. And so they were able to put that time into it this time around. And I really just loved it. I just loved it this time around. So this is one of my favorite episodes of certainly the second season, maybe of the overall show, because they're in this situation that, you know, only this show really has, the situation of, you know, the taking over with these Gould and hosts and ancient Egypt, somebody's thousands and thousands of years old. They just took all these elements that were really already there and just made something really, really powerful with it. I really liked it.
One thing that's interesting that makes Apophis a little more of a person in this episode is that he keeps calling out for his wife, his queen, Amunet,
yep.
in a way that, you know, it really seems like she's not just a symbol or possession of his. He really, you know, is calling out for comfort and love and of whatever kind, although Jack finds it hard to believe that he or any Gould could really love anything, but at least a very codependent, interdependent relationship with his queen.
And what is he loving, right? Like every time he looks at his quote-unquote queen, he's looking at an unrelated human person.
Right.
It's really weird. But yes, again, I think they sold the fact that He has a strong emotional attachment to this other Gould. So, yeah.
Having the Gould having unhealthy relationships with other people's bodies, it seems to fit really well with the show. I don't think it's a problem. It's a feature.
Right. Yeah.
Right. It's definitely an intentional thing, I think.
Yep. As much as you can depict that in any way that's realistic, right? Because, of course, it doesn't actually happen that way. So they can't really know what it would be like. Again, his death scene, I think it felt really powerful because it felt like something, you know, he was acting the way a person would act, a human would act on their deathbed. And I think that's the only way to do it, right?
Yeah.
Thousands of years in a horrible nightmare.
Well, again, you know, I don't remember exactly how long it was, but, you know, the main part of the episode is Apophis being on his deathbed. And then we knew that each one of the SG-1 team members would come talk with him, mm-hmm. right? So Teal came to gloat. Jackson came to bargain. I think Carter came first with sort of more of the scientific angle.
No, I think she was last because she had the problem of how to defend against Sokar's attack.
Right.
Oh, okay, yeah. And that was maybe the least emotionally satisfying because she just didn't have that connection with him. But, you know, still kind of interesting. And also, you know, Apophis being just kind of a jerk about the whole thing. Like, no, I'm not going to help you. I'm going to pretend I'm doing worse than I am. Maybe, like, again, this whole thing with the show that they have to always go back to square one. They've got to reset. And, you know, you feel that in this episode, too. They don't really learn anything from him mm-hmm. that can be worthwhile.
I felt like that was pretty true to the character of Apophis, though. He would not have traded any information that he could help.
Though it confused me a bit, because half the time it seemed like Apophis would have liked their protection and wanted a new host. And half the time he came here because then Sokar would kill all the humans, and he thought that was funny. And I couldn't quite tell sometimes which it was.
Yeah.
I think a really old and subtle Gould could do things for multiple reasons like that. You know, if the humans saved him, great. And if not, well, at least he gets to take the humans down with him. It's a win-win scenario for him.
But I suppose that means that Apophis actually had nothing he could have told them which would have helped. Because why wouldn't he have helped them defend against Sokar's attack?
Because he hates humans?
Yeah, I know. It was just complicated. You could never quite read him, and it works well in the story.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
They can't read him either. It's really hard. So I don't know whether Apophis was actually keeping anything from them just to make sure they died too.
Yeah, I wonder if the plan was if they give him a new host, then he helps them enough to keep Sokar off their back. But only then.
I don't know.
Maybe. And absolutely. Just the fact that he's so insufferable, even when he's totally at their mercy, was great.
Right.
It was really fun.
Absolutely in character.
Right. Yeah, that was really great. I mean, he might have told them just enough for humans to hold off Sokar for a little while Apophis tried to escape to some other place. Let's see. Something else interesting is that Apophis sensed the presence within Samantha of Jolinar and said that, I am sure you will make an excellent host for Sokar's new queen. So
creepy.
Queens all over the place, I guess.
It's just what he says to all the pretty women. He's just a creep.
That's disturbing, but funny.
Well, it's interesting that this episode, like some of our other episodes, sort of half involves the Tok'ra. It's not really a Tok'ra episode by itself.
Token Tok'ra.
Token Tok'ra.
But they're willing to use the Tok'ra as reoccurring characters for the sake of moving the plot along.
Right.
Because, again, there's so many things that they would have no idea what Sokar was about mm-hmm. unless the Tok'ra could tell them some of the details of it. So that was part of the episode.
I was so, so, so happy that they were given a GDO at the end of this episode.
Yes.
Mainly because at the beginning of the episode, I was yelling at the screen saying, why in the world don't they have one of those little things for sending a transmit code?
Right. It's not real great to say, don't call us, we'll call you when you don't have the device to signal them with.
They're risking Sam's dad being splattered on the iris because maybe they'll misinterpret the radiation signature on something they throw in.
Yeah.
That is the mechanism? It's like, you gotta be kidding. Mm-hmm. Who would ever go to Earth? Earth is a death trap. Well, I was blown away by it. So at least, like, well, and why don't the Tok'ra have something like a MELP? Like, why can't they send a little flying drone through it?
Yes,
and
indeed.
Get a signal back. But only the humans uses a MELP-like thing. Everyone else just assumes they're not going to instantly die. Oh, it annoyed me at the beginning of the episode. But now it's gone. Now they have a GDO. Yeah. I don't have to worry about it anymore. But boy, that bugged me at the beginning of this episode.
Well, they have a GDO, and the people on Earth now have, like, a device from the...
The Talon.
Yeah.
Message device.
Right.
Yeah, which we actually see in a later episode mm-hmm. that we're going to talk about. So,
yep.
Apophis is being a jerk to the people on Earth. The Tok'ra being jerks to the people on Earth. I mean, it's not like we don't deserve it. It is kind of funny that nobody's treating us the way Jack wants us to be treated, right?
I quite like Martouf's line at the end where basically he's saying, yeah, you guys wanted to try and impose your morality and not hand over someone to be tortured forever. Nah, too bad. That's happening anyway.
Yeah.
Well, he withheld that information.
I think so, yes.
I am pretty sure he knew that the humans thought they were just turning over a dead body, and he knew all the time.
All the time, yeah.
Of course he did.
That Sokar would be reviving him. He just withheld that information because he wanted to be sure that they did what he wanted them to do.
The young sometimes do when they're what they're supposed to.
He says it like, duh, of course they have a sarcophagus.
It's almost an as you know, Bob line, but it's actually surprising because it guts so much of the point of the entire episode.
Right.
It isn't the best as you know, Bob line where Jackson comes up with the idea that we just have to dial out before they dial back in.
Oh, gosh. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And Hammond is so proud of Jackson at that point. I'm assuming he's not being condescending. I love that. Because we all know you can do that, Jackson.
Yes.
It was the most heavy-handed. Audience, remember, we can do this. Okay, I remember.
Oh my gosh, that was, yes, roll my eyes, totally at that. Like, and it's also like, you know, we need to give poor Michael Shanks something to do in this episode besides, you know, have one conversation with Apophis. So
yeah, I mean, I was typing in all caps, you know, wait, you can't do this. This is going to go badly. And then it immediately went badly. So I was satisfied.
I like the technological question of the race to dialing. Like, I like that about this show, that the most critical thing on using Stargates for combat is who can dial faster. And I'm assuming being local helps you on that race, but I like that aspect of it where there's some technological thing, some Stargate science, and it does matter.
Right. And you can deduce some things and predict some things, although they don't always quite hold to the line. Okay, so I have a question. Was Daniel just humoring the host when he said he was going to take the body and bury it in all honor and lay him to rest in Egypt? Was he humoring him and lying at the same time? Because didn't he already know they were going to send the body back? And then he came up with the, you breathe into this statuette as you die and we'll bury that instead as a substitute.
I didn't remember the promise. I thought he was taking the breath in the statue and then was going to bury the statue or something like that. I didn't think he was implying actually the body would get buried. I thought he was like trying. Like, I was impressed enough that the show was having an attempt to show humanity to a lost culture and Jackson actually knowing the right things. It's a great scene for Jackson where I actually know something that can comfort this dying person. And he's the only person on Earth who probably can do it.
Right. And it did visibly comfort him.
I don't think he really promised. I didn't get the impression that he promised that, but maybe I missed it.
Yeah.
I remember the statue part of it is all that I remember. There was more going on, but I wasn't really paying too much attention to the specific details.
Yeah. But that, of course, just makes it sting all the more that the host is going to get revived and tortured along with Apophis, the snake.
The Hammond debriefing scenes, which are generally the place where all the good exposition happens. This episode did a pretty good job there because that's where they're saying, this is a morality tale that we're giving you. And Hammond offers the prisoner of war rights argument, which was kind of weak. And then Carter brings up the host argument, which is a much better argument.
Yeah.
But I really liked still them using these debriefing sessions as a means of focusing the point of the story, even if they're a little heavy-handed, but I do enjoy them.
Right.
The only other thing I wanted to mention was there was a scene at the very beginning where the Death Gliders are coming over the gate and they're not firing because they don't want to actually kill Apophis either. But then one of them kind of hovers right by the gate and then like shoots into it. And I thought that was a pretty neat. The special effects are not the strongest in this show. They don't have the most money that any show had, even of the time. But that was a nice little shot.
And it was nice and consistent because it gave us the moment where they would have been able to point a camera and look at the address. So it felt, it made sense also because that's what gave them Earth's address, which, to be fair, a nice scene. It looked good. It looked fuzzy, but it looked good.
They always look fuzzy, yeah. I mean, the other nice bit, and again, David, you mentioned how unrealistic it is, but, you know, a face showing up on the iris from, like, bombarded particles. Like, no, that's not how that works. But, you know, having this and this deep voice coming out of it.
The face I could deal with.
Yeah.
It's a cathode ray tube. It's a particle beam, which they're spewing over it to draw a face. I can cope with that. It was the speaker bit that blew me away.
It was the voice, yeah.
And then it doesn't do anything to the plot. He said nothing they didn't already know.
Right.
I liked it anyway. I liked it. It was nice and creepy, and I liked it.
It was creepy.
Yeah, it was nice and creepy. And I can see the argument for using any kind of radiation beam like that and modulating the signal to get a message through. But the speaker bit, you're right. It's a little iffy.
I would have just been happier had it said something that moved the plot or communicated something, but all they did was tell us everything that the Tok'ra had already communicated.
I mean, this is kind of the first time we're actually seeing Sokar, even though we're not seeing Sokar. And yeah, you're right. You're right. It didn't give anything in the plot, but I do think that sense of menace was enhanced by having that message come across.
And having the power to do that SGC didn't know someone could do.
Right. This is something we haven't seen from any other Guo before. Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, Apophis couldn't do it. Herawur. Well, I don't know if they've dealt with Herawur directly before, but wow, Apophis is the only one they've really dealt with so far, right?
Well, and Ra.
And Ra. Oh, well, and Hathor.
Right.
So anyways, yeah. So, but you're right. You're right. It didn't. In general, the show does well when it combines something emotionally relevant, something resonant with the part of the plot, because it's very plot heavy, our episodes. But I didn't mind this one.
There were two other conversations with SG-1 team and Apophis I liked. I did quite like O'Neill to his line as he watches Apophis dies. That's between you and your god. Oh, wait a minute. You are your god.
Yeah, I knew that was coming. Yeah, yeah.
Twist that knife, O'Neill. You're enjoying it.
Yep.
Yep.
Quite a very O'Neill line. I quite like that one. And even better was the one with Teal'c, where Teal'c not only is gloating, but when describing how the Jaffa are going to keep surviving, that they are going to basically use the Gould symbionts as food.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was quite a line.
And as a sweet irony. And Apophis is shocked by that. And it was beautifully played.
Right, right. We're going to find symbionts, use them until they mature, and
beautiful.
Then discard them. And, you know, so we'll be using you the way you've used us. Yeah, that was really something.
That's a beautiful use of irony and just pushing an aspect of the story and the world building and then just twisting it really nicely. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a great, great line.
Yep.
Okay, well, let's move on to a lighter episode. Holiday, I believe, Andrew, you have a recap.
Well, sort of a lighter episode, sort of not a lighter episode.
Well, yeah.
There are light aspects to it, sure. SG-1 visits the home of the alien Muchago, who was an old and dying inventor of technology to fight the Goa'uld. Muchago uses one of his inventions to trick Daniel into switching bodies with him. So Daniel's younger body for Muchago's old and dying body, and then uses Daniel's body to explore the wonders of Earth, like French fries and ice cream sundaes. So Michael Shanks gets to do the whole Richard Dean Anderson thing of acting like a non-human for an episode. He's got different speech patterns, different body language. You can tell he's having fun with it. Shanks is also actually the one playing Muchago directly under a ton of makeup. So Daniel and Muchago actually have a pretty intense conversation at the end, and it's funny to realize it's Michael Shanks talking to himself. There's actually a decent amount of body switching. Christopher Judge gets to act like O'Neill. Richard Dean Anderson gets to act like Teal'c. There's a decent amount of the SG-1 twee music, which for me usually indicates a bad episode, but this one was actually pretty good. So some of it was played for laughs. There was this alien, you know, interacting with regular people and all of that. And that was, you know, again, sort of lighthearted. But there was also, again, this real conversation at the end about what you deserve for what you've sacrificed.
Mm-hmm.
They handled it really, really well. They handled it really nicely, that sort of keeping it serious at the end there and keeping it, while keeping it sort of a general purpose discussion of philosophical ideas, also making it feel compelling because there were real people involved. Now, it's a reset episode because Muchago dies before being able to give them access to his advanced technology. So you don't need to watch it. But again, I thought this was one of the better one-offs that I saw this season. And I liked it.
I've definitely been skipping a lot of body swapping, funky body replacing episodes. It occurs to me there's a lot more of those than I've been watching in this show.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely a bottle episode because ultimately nothing ends up affecting the arcs.
Right.
There are some nice moments. The Christopher Judge imitating Jack O'Neill is really fun. You know, the language that he uses, the intonations, the body language, you know, he really does a good job with it. You know, it almost sounds...
He gets to have facial expressions.
The facial expressions too. It almost sounds a few times like they're dubbing...
Really? No.
Richard Dean Anderson in. But no, it's Christopher Judge is just a pretty good mimic. So that was a lot of fun. And of course, Jack O'Neill gets to imitate Teal'c, but that's, you know, imitating the stiffness, I think, is probably a little easier. Okay, so beyond that, what Andrew was saying about the conversations about your rights and things was also really interesting, because Marcello says that I sacrificed so much, and I'm so smart, and I can help you all, and so I deserve this body. And Daniel, in Marcello's body, tells Marcello in Daniel's body that he is acting like a Gould himself.
Yep.
And that takes Marcello aback, but he is maintaining, you know, I'm more important. And Daniel then tells him about still wanting to try to find his wife. Then Marcello says, well, whether or not I wanted to help you, it's impossible to switch back.
Yep.
But Sam figures out a musical chairs body swap that lets them all get back to their proper bodies.
Again, so many of these episodes feel like adventure game puzzles. They're really simple, but there is a trick to it. And this is definitely one of those. So yeah, that was fun.
Right. There was also a moment that, hit me a little differently now than it did back in the 90s when I was watching it, which is when Marcello is roaming around to the city, he makes friends with this beggar named Fred, who is a black man. I don't know if he's homeless or what, but he's definitely out there, you know, asking people for spare change. And they have a lovely feast together at a restaurant after Daniel figures out what a credit card is. And eventually, when they leave the restaurant, they get surrounded by cops. Fred tells Marcello not to resist. I know these guys, so don't resist. Just let them do it. And they slam Daniel against the police car and handcuffs him. And Fred tells the cops not to hurt Marcello. He's a hero.
He's a war hero, right.
And All that with the, you know, don't resist. I know these guys, you know, obviously in this time hit me a lot different than it did back then watching it.
This is not the sort of show that's really going to explore those issues, but
no, and I don't think they were making a huge point of it back then, but I just thought it was an interesting sidelight on how stuff that was a small matter of fact sidelight in that can come through very differently when
that's true.
Viewed with 2021 eyes.
So yeah, I think that's it for Holiday.
Yeah, it wasn't a bad episode. It's not necessary, but it, you know, wouldn't hurt to watch it for anyone who is interested in a thorough rewatch.
Yeah, and you know, it's got my thumbs up, and I don't give those out very often. So
I might just watch it then. I'll think about it.
Moving on to an episode I don't recommend.
Thank you.
To One False Step. Okay, so SG-1 visits an unusual planet where the locals don't speak, don't use tools, and don't wear clothes, but they do wear white paint for whatever reason. The locals start falling sick almost immediately because of course.
Oh.
Turns out to be because the UAV that crashed into a plant changed what ultrasonic tone the plants were emitting. And all SG-1 needs to do is set up big speakers to broadcast the original tone, and things are fine again.
Wow.
One I talk to my plants joke later, and the episode is done. If you think, wow, that's all that happened in an hour? Well, yeah, it was pretty slow. You could see the bodysuits on the people playing the aliens. Like, it just wasn't. I just didn't get very much out of it. When you have, like, people trying to pretend to be basically plant-like creatures, there's only so much that you can do with that concept in my mind.
All right. I feel a little defensive about this episode because it is it is one of the very few episodes of Stargate that I was able to watch with my sister because we were on vacation together.
Okay.
And so
I await your rebuttal, counselor.
There are some things that are interesting in this show. The whole thing with Daniel sneezing, and they think for a while that they have infected these people with some Earth biological infection.
Well, and they kind of say, well, you know, it was going to happen eventually, which
yeah, and that's kind of chilling, the fact that, you know, Dr. Frazier says, you know, I'm surprised this hasn't happened before, which means that they are all very cavalierly carrying their germs all over the galaxy without protective suits or anything. And they say, it's okay when we visit human planets, because, you know, those people carried their own Earth diseases out with them anyway, which, if you know history, you know that before the global population mixing, there were big pandemics that were caused by explorers visiting new territories. So that's bad in itself, but also the fact that they can go to other planets and maybe infect other species, and they're just not really worrying about that all, is rather disturbing. And then it all gets hand-waved away at the end.
Are you saying they did this story and they didn't actually make it a morality tale about how colonialists are horrible?
Well,
like, that's the only reason you would do this story.
They presented the fact that it could be horribly colonialist, but then they just made it about technology and plant songs instead.
Oh.
So they really took an easy out on that.
Well, and they had to, right? Because otherwise, the show is trying to depict what it thinks of as good people. And if they were really taking into account how colonialist their actions are, they wouldn't be good people. And you couldn't have the show. And, you know, I get the bind that they find themselves in, but bringing it up the way they did here and then dismissing it, again, like, just not that big of a deal. Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah, so some things need more than a lantern.
Yes, I have personal reasons for having some sentimentality about this episode, but in general, probably most people should skip it.
Was this the only episode of SG-1 she's seen? Like it?
No, we both watched it separately, and we would talk about it on the phone, okay. But this was one that we actually got to watch together and, you know, react together in the same room, you know, before the days of when long distance was free and you could watch separately in, you know, different cities.
Sure. Okay.
On your TV at the same time and talk to each other on the phone if you wanted to. This was back in the 90s, and, you know, we lived apart and we got to watch this show together. And this happened to be the episode that we watched together.
And there were some lighter moments in the episode, some fun bits. I don't remember what they are anymore.
Well, you know, I liked that the aliens sang to each other. I liked that, you know, they didn't have medicine, but they would pat the hands of the people who were sick, trying to comfort them, which was rather sweet, if ineffectual.
Well, and they have paint. They paint each other.
Right.
That's what they do. I think that's it for me for that episode. If that's it for you, Trish, I think we can... We can move on.
Show and tell. David, please. What happened?
An unexpected off-world activation and a misbehaving Iris brings a young boy to SGC to warn them. Charlie will only speak to O'Neill and his invisible Ritu mother. Apparently, an invisible group of rebel Ritu are going to attack Earth and all other planets with humans, trying to stop the Gould from getting new hosts. Really? SGC signals the Tok'ra for help, who have a weapon that can see and kill the Ritu. The Transphase Eradication Rod. Wow, what a name. Charlie wants to stay with O'Neill. It's very sweet. SG-1 and a bunch of armed troops this time gate to an address and they spy on hundreds of rebel Ritu. But apparently some invisible Ritu rebels sneaked into the SGC and attack. 5 rebel Ritus are popped, but one of the rebels also kills Mother. It's very sad. Charlie falls unconscious and is going to die, so the Tok'ra take him and, as only a symbiont, will save him now.
And we never see him again.
Oh, are you serious? I want to see him. I have a story. I have fan fiction now. This is a Tok'ra who could have a symbiote and can see.
That's true.
The Ritu. So I think he's going to be like become really tough master Ritu assassin.
That's true. Yeah.
Because he can go around and see the Ritu. Like I had this whole fan fiction planned out for this character.
I encourage you to go ahead and write it, David. Because that's the only way we're going to see it.
Oh, that's so sad. I thought the actor did a really good job. It's a hard role to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's another, you know, O'Neill interacts with the child episode.
Right. And the child actually asks if Jack can be his dad. But of course, that would change the show too much. So nobody on this show can marry or have children.
And takes his dead son's name.
Yes.
Like it's poor O'Neill. This is hard. Yeah.
Just like that crystalline entity did, too.
Yeah, second time, too.
Well, it's kind of all they have, right? Like, he has a son. So we've got to have him relate to this child via his son. They do this with such clockwork that it feels like it's written into his contract that, like, every so often, gotta interact with a child actor. That's just part of the deal. And this was one of the, you know, this is one of the better ones of that approach, certainly better than the poor Teal'c episode with that girl.
Mm-hmm.
It's still kind of funny that, like, you know, that's all you can do. That's It makes a certain amount of sense, right? Oh, okay, they had to force grow this child, this alien race. And okay, but again, they just somehow managed to stick a kid into a whole bunch of O'Neill episodes. But again, this is also a Toker episode, another Toker episode. And this one we get Samantha's dad, whose name I'm blanking on, to come back. And that actor is really...
Jacob Selmack.
He's really fun. Oh,
the actor, I don't remember the actor's name.
I will remember that at some point. He's going to come back, so I'll get more chances. It's just funny that, again, they kind of put those two things together. Okay, we're going to have a child episode and a Toker episode, and we're just going to smush them together because that's, you know, we kind of have time for all that. So the other thing I wanted to mention was just the whole thing at the beginning where they're like, he's got an imaginary friend, and we're going to humor him.
Right, right.
Did anyone watching this believe that the mother wasn't there?
Nope.
Like, obviously the mother's there.
Right. Anytime a character gets knowledge that they shouldn't have, there's going to be a good reason for it.
Well, it's the Hathor thing all over again, mm-hmm. right? That they just so oblivious, like, you're the ones defending our planet from these horrible baddies? Like, you?
I like it, though, because at least in this episode, the writers realize they've done this too much. And I really love Charlie's line, Mother is growing impatient with your narrow-mindedness. And then blows up a computer screen.
Right.
That was wonderful.
I'm right there with you, Mom. I want to blow up my computer, too.
That was so good. Almost up with Charlie saying, we're crying out loud.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't let him go to sleep. Like, there's some great stuff.
He has learned some language since he got here.
Well, he's learned from O'Neill,
yes,
I think.
Yes, definitely sounded like an O'Neill intonation.
But Charlie generally is a good audience surrogate for really just having enough of these people.
Yeah.
By the way, this episode does have callbacks to an episode that we had you skip, David, which was Spirits. But I hope that wasn't much of a problem for you.
This is where they're mining and they went to the Tonane or something like that.
Yes, that's right.
And you know, it worked just fine. I think it works perfectly well that there are references to things you don't see. There's no reason you can't write it that way anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So unless the experience with the Tonane was really good, I'm okay in this context because nothing happened in it that it mattered. It was just this thing happened and I came back that time. Fine. No problem. I'm good.
There's so no way this kid would know that without... And they don't seem to be bothered that like, oh yeah, my mom has been here for a couple of weeks. Like, you have an alien wandering around your complex for a couple of weeks and you're just not worried about it? But yeah. Okay. I got that off my chest. I'm good.
I can give you another thing to complain about, Andrew. When did the pronunciation of Jaffa become Jaffa?
Well.
I noticed that too. I'm not sure it's a permanent change. It might just be a Jacob Selmack actor way of calling those people.
And the kid also did a Jaffa.
Yeah.
No, they've gone back and forth. They've gone back and forth the whole time.
Okay. It bothered me a little bit in this episode going, really?
Well, I mean, you know, Gould versus Goa'uld, Jaffa versus Jaffa. I also noticed the Tokers say Cree the same way that the Goa'uld do, in the sense that they basically say one word as if it's a whole sentence.
Yes.
Like, attention is not enough information for you to know what to do next.
Do the thing.
Do the thing, yeah. Basically. Oh, so funny.
You know, maybe it's a tonal thing that we just don't get all the inflections of meaning that are in there.
Yeah. When, of course, the Tokra, the other Tokra who is not Carter's dad, is a red shirt.
I would have felt bad for that Tokra dying, except Carter has a line and the Tokra just sits there groaning for no reason and waits until Carter's done their line to start acting and then dies. And I thought it was just so badly managed on set that one moment that I was very happy to see him go.
Oh, boy.
Okay, so I have a whole big problem with the premise for the Ritu rebels who have decided that what they are going to do about their species nearly being eliminated is not to go after the actual people who did that, but they want to destroy all the potential hosts, which would be billions of people on thousands, probably, of planets, which seems like a really poor strategy.
Bad plan.
Bad plan, Ripley.
Just a bad plan.
Yep.
But the show's honest about it. The show agrees with you that it's a bad plan. Everyone else thinks it's a bad plan. It's clearly a stupid plan.
Mm-hmm.
We're not supposed to give these rebels much credit, and we're not supposed to care very much when they use that CGI exploding animation on them.
Mm-hmm.
Because, their plan is bad.
The point where the mother explodes is really graphic. Like,
yes.
The show obviously doesn't actually care enough about mother to not show her gruesome death on screen, which I thought was interesting.
I was surprised by that a bit.
Right, and it's exploding green and black insect parts instead of good human pink flesh exploding, so they can get away with it being really gooey.
And what would you expect from a transphase extermination rod?
Well, I guess so their base is like full of like transphasic like blood and guts that nobody ever cleans up because
they
no
don't
one
have
can.
To clean it up. It's out of phase. Like as soon as it goes out of the view of the TER, you can't see the fact that the room is covered in goo.
Right, but it's nice green goo instead of red meat blood.
It's CGI, and I have noticed like both here and in many other places that like CGI, like you know, in movies like Aquaman or anything else, where they show battles and things like that in CGI that are so much more graphic than it would be if they were showing you know people fighting. It's just, it is sort of funny how so unself-aware I think shows are. And I think that carries over to this as well, that they're like, ooh, we can show cool, you know, animations and things without really thinking about, yeah, we're showing creatures dying.
The fact is these are somewhat dehumanized creatures. We never get to see them speak. They look like bugs.
Right.
We're supposed to think they look scary. Like it's hard because this show is not, and to be fair, most of them are zealots with a stupid plan. So it's hard. They try to make us care about Mother, and they kind of succeed. It's a little shocking when Mother goes, but it's hard because they're not really there.
Well, I also thought it was funny that on the other planet, these creatures who are obviously highly technological mm-hmm. are shown as milling around in a herd on a plane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of, wait, that doesn't make any sense. That's just there so they can show a lot of them together without needing a huge amount of CGI to do it, basically how that works, yeah.
Well, just seeing their tents where they're building their bombs just wouldn't have been as exciting.
I suppose not.
But yeah, no, but absolutely, they are underplayed there at all for the fact that they are, to some degree, obviously, cultured, technologically advanced. They'd have supply lines. They'd be building things. No, they're just running around because that's how much we could afford to CG.
Yeah, there's obviously some problems with their technological advancements, though, because the boy that Mom built had built in, or you know, not intentional, but just deficiencies that was killing him. And you know, as Fraser was speculating at the beginning without knowing anything about this, it was like, you know, someone just had a kit and put a human together but didn't really know what they were doing. And so that is why Charlie is dying. So yeah, they are certainly intelligent, but they are by no means, you know, tech gods.
Well, I'm not sure we can really cast any disparagements, given that we can't grow humans at all technologically.
And I think they made it very clear that that was a rush job.
Mm-hmm.
I think Mother could have probably done a just fine job, but really time was of the essence. Like, we don't know, did she only have a week to do this and then had to get it done? And like, it's a bit of a hard thing to ask.
Well, making it happen in a day is, yeah.
And they also are carrying around little bombs, bomb grenades that can apparently nuke cities. So
mm-hmm.
I would be hesitant to question their technological. It's just we didn't get to see it.
Yeah.
Right. Well, obviously they have some kind of psychological, well, they may not be oddities to them, but they are different from humans. I mean, it's quite elaborate instead of saying, I will contact these humans and warn them, to say, I'm going to find some human residue somewhere, build a boy out of that, and have him be the intermediary. Which, given that, you know, some humans can be fairly paranoid, you can see it as a strategy for trying to reach out to humans, but I'm kind of astonished that they weren't more horrified by the idea of building a boy as a messenger instead of just reaching out and saying, hey, there's a problem. I'm a bug, but you need to hear this.
Like, you know, humans should be mature enough to be able to deal with another species which doesn't look like them, but apparently they're not. But it's also like the whole reason for this, like we can argue back and forth about exactly why they decided to do it like this. But the reason they decided to do it like this was so that there could be a cute child in an SG-1 episode.
Right.
And more than that, a cute dying child in an SG-1 episode. Tug at the heartstrings. I mean, you know, they work backwards from there.
A bald one, too, as if a cancer survivor. Like, mm-hmm. they're not holding back.
Yeah, it is kind of fun to talk about it. But I also, for me personally, it's like, yeah, I'm only going to argue this so far because it's just so obvious where this came from. And I'm just gonna run with it because it's the show. This is how the show goes. They put it together pretty well. Like, you know, some of the faults we were talking about, but it's got pretty good pacing. It's got pretty good knowledge revelation. The pace of the revelations is pretty good and a little bit of action there at the end. And, you know, it's a pretty good SG-1 episode.
And the Tok'ra are much better handled than in the previous one I watched.
Yeah.
Because they call them, they come. They're not risking getting hit by the iris. So much nicer.
Well, they even show a little tiny scene with them standing, like sitting outside.
Right.
You know, at night, and the little beam goes up the way it did in the Tolan episode. Yeah, a little bit of callback there.
However, for the Tok'ra, it's a net.
It is.
Zero, because although they gained the little boy as a host, one of Jacob's assistants died at the hands of one of the bugs. And so, you know, they haven't actually increased the Tok'ra population any.
They've lost a symbiote. So
We don't know if they did, though. Like, how long can the symbiote live after the hosts had their chest shot out? So it's always possible that they
yeah, that was also pretty graphic.
Maybe.
They may have been able to save that one. They didn't make it very clear.
Well, I was like, oh, is that fall going to kill him? Oh yeah, the hole. Yeah. Oh, well. They actually break that glass, like, every couple of episodes.
They do, yeah. You'd think they'd make it shatter resistant or something.
Well, it is bulletproof or bullet resistant, right? Because there was the arrow
right
hit it in the Tonani episode, but didn't go through. So it's arrow proof.
Good job. I was considering going after some Stargate science. We have the great line, according to quantum physics.
Oh, God.
Sciencey Stargate science words here. Mm. Their light and sound waves would be undetectable to us. Mm. And I wanted to go after it, and I wanted to think it's silly. But the problem is, I love the Ro and Geordi Star Trek TNG episode, The Next Phase, so much that I just have to give the show this. So let's give it to them.
Well, it's also the Flash, right? Like the whole, if you vibrate at a certain frequency, you go into another universe. Like, yeah, the science fiction shows really love that approach, even if it's ridiculous.
They threw so many words at it.
That's Carter's job.
No, I'm pretty sure Carter's job is expertly throwing grenades and blowing things up.
Oh, yeah, that was
and
nice.
This time, she threw the grenade, bounced it off a table into a door that was opening and closing. Just to delay the Ritu in there before she blew it up. Like, she knows how to use those grenades.
Yes. All right. I guess that about wraps it up for this episode of the podcast. We have two more episodes of season 2 to cover. Yeah. Then we'll probably do another kind of season recap. But anyway, so yeah, we have two arc important episodes here. One of them has a lot of really good meaty stuff in it. I definitely recommend watching Serpent's Song.
Was Ritu? Were you talking about Ritu being the other arc episode?
Yeah, the Serpent Song and Show and Tell, I think, are the ones. Well, maybe Show and Tell is not that important for the arc, but you do have more of the Tok'ra working together with the humans. I don't actually remember if we see the Ritu anymore after this.
I hope we at least see the transphase eradication rod.
Just because you memorized the name of the weapon. Yeah, right.
It's such an amazing name.
Yeah, it's no Zat, but sure.
It's a Tur. Tur. Doesn't sound quite as good as a Zat.
No. I actually did like the Muchella episode, the holiday episode, better than Show and Tell, which is kind of a weird feeling. But yeah, sorry.
Yeah, it's entertaining.
I think, go back and try Holiday. The one thing I like, or at least I think it's interesting what they've changed in season 2, is in season 1, their sarcophagus was the, we cannot have, if anyone has to not die, we can solve that. But they nerfed the sarcophagus by saying that it's an addictive drug and makes you evil. Mm-hmm. And now the Tok'ra are the nobody has to die, but now there's a price to pay on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it interesting that the Tok'ra have kind of replaced the sarcophagus as a way out of having anyone die if the plot needs it to be. And the Tok'ra will just take them away to the islands of the West or something like that.
I actually did find that a little unconvincing at the end because O'Neill was so against the symbiotes And yet it felt like the show needed, like, okay, everything worked back to the fact that they wanted a cute kid in the episode. And so...
And they didn't want them to die.
Right.
They didn't want them to die, right? Because that would be, you know, it's almost like there's this sort of invisible standards and practices mm-hmm. that they didn't want to go beyond. Like, here's what a mainstream show is willing to do, and here's what it isn't willing to do. We're not willing to kill a kid. And so they had to do something, and this was all they had.
When the hand went limp.
Yeah.
When Jack was hugging him, it's like, oh my. Seriously.
Yeah. I
was actually surprised they pulled the Toker solution for saving the child. And I'm even more offended that we never see them again, but oh well.
Yeah, because, you know, it would be a good, you know, recurring thing, because the show has shown that it can do that. It can sort of weave existing characters into new situations, and they just, it was a bit of a missed opportunity.
Maybe they were leaving their options open at the time and things just didn't work out that way for the next season. Yeah,
maybe.
I don't think they planned everything that happened in season two, for example, in season one. It's just they used what they could think of to make new episodes in season two. And yeah, again, they just didn't get to it. They had enough other things going on.
Well, I look forward to the next episodes, the end of season two.
Season two, yep.
Okay, well, this was fun talking with you guys again about the episodes. I enjoyed it.
So, and I will mention our Twitter account, Stargate_SG_fun.
And I guess that'll be it. Thanks for your time, listeners, and we'll be talking to you later.
Bye-bye.
Have a good night.